Accession number 32297, Reel 1.
John Dixon, Reel 1. John, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Ushasari, December 1924.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, my father actually, at the time that the Second World War broke out, he was working in the city, but he had been a gunner officer in the First World War. He was twice decorated for gallantry, and as kids growing up, of course, we were always interested, but he never talked too much about it. He obviously had some pretty horrific experiences, which made me, as a young lad, realise that whatever happened, the last thing I wanted to do was to be a soldier. So there we are.
What about your early education?
Well, I went to what we call a grammar school now, I suppose, which was Tiffin's in Kingston. When I left there, I was 17 and a bit, and went straight into the Fleet Air Arm.
Given that you went into the Fleet Air Arm, were you interested in aviation in the sort of pre-war period at all?
Yes, I suppose from about the age of 12... aviation, of course, was the big thing in the 30s. Amy Johnson and Campbell Black and all these people. And as young kids, we loved it. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I'd read all the books about Ball, McCudden, Mannock, Richthofen, everything to do with the First World War. And, of course, I was just hooked on the thought of one day being a pilot. But no way was that ever going to happen, because we couldn't afford to learn to fly in those days. And then when the war came, I was just 15. And I just thought to myself, well, now's an opportunity. Can they keep the war going long enough for me to join in?
Did you make models of aircraft, that sort of thing?
No, I'm never very good with my hands. I'm not very good. But two good friends of mine were into that sort of thing, and one of them, who was a little bit older than me, well, a good bit older than me, actually joined the Fleet Air Arm right at the beginning of the war, trained as a pilot. He lived locally in Esher, and he was an only son. And surprisingly, he was one of the course that flew during the beginning of the war, and they were seconded immediately to the RAF, who were short of pilots. So, as a sub lieutenant, he was flying a Whitley bomber over France with number 76 squadron, I think, and was shot down on return from a raid somewhere in Germany. And that was that. Peter Hode was his name.
At 15, obviously, the war had started. Had you been aware of the sort of coming conflict in Europe? Was it something that was people were aware of at the time? Yes.
I mean, as young kids growing up in the 30s, I mean, we were very well aware of what the naughty Germans were up to, that sort of thing. I suppose one thing I do remember is that we thought we knew that the Navy was so superior. I could just remember the names of the battleship: Nelson, Hood, Repulse, Rodney, Renown, Ramillies, Royal Sovereign, Royal Oak, Malaya, Valiant, Warspite, all these tremendous huge battleships. We were superior. So we always thought, well, whatever the Germans do, our Navy is much better than theirs. But there we are.
And that period you were still at school, obviously, when the war broke out. How did the war affect the kind of Esher area?
Well, I watched a bit of the Battle of Britain, because some of it took place over our heads. One thing I do remember particularly well, a good chum of mine, who also lived near me in Esher, we cycled into Kingston, where our school was, on the 4th of September 1940, because we had been told that our school exam results, what we call general schools matric, which is now O-levels or whatever you call it, I don't know, but we were told that the results were published and were posted on the school notice board. But we had to go and find them ourselves. So we cycled in to Kingston, on the way home, delighted with our results, absolutely over the moon. We got as far as the Scilly Isles roundabout, just the Kingston side of Esher, and there was this almighty air raid taking place. And we could see that they were going for the Vickers works at Weybridge. And we recognised, because we were all air cadets and all, and we could recognise that they were Messerschmitts and Junkers and all this sort of thing. And we knew that it was Vickers that was being bombed. I think 70, 80 people were killed there that day. I was delighted to get home with my school results, tell my mum and all that sort of thing. Poor Eric, my chum, he got home and his mother was beside herself with anxiety because Eric's older brother worked at Vickers. But he did survive, so that was that.
You mentioned that you've been in the Air Cadets. When did you join the Air Cadets?
That's a good story. When I first started at grammar school, we were in what we called the OTC, Officer Training Corps, khaki uniform, puttees and all this sort of thing. And we stomped about on Chobham ridges doing field days and that sort of thing, carrying a rifle. we were far too small to actually carry rifles, but we managed it. And then about 1938, I think it was, or maybe in 37, they started what was called the Air Defence Cadet Corps. So those of us that were air-minded switched into that. And our school had what they called the number 26F, which was Founder, 26 Founder Squadron. And then when the war came, and I suppose it was about 1940, the Air Defence Cadet Corps stopped existing, or didn't exist anymore, and the Air Training Corps took over. But we were still 26F Squadron in the Air Training Corps. I got two stripes, I was a corporal.
When did you meet?
When did I meet?
When did you meet with the Air Training Corps? Was there a specific
time? Oh, we met at school. No, it was just, I think it was once or twice a week after school. There were lectures and parades and that sort of thing.
So was there an element there of drill at that stage?
Oh yes, we did all the drill and form threes, form fours in those days it was. And yes, we did all that, and we had an air marshal come and inspect us and told us what good lads we were. And we had a band. No, I wasn't in the band, but my friend Eric, he played a trombone. So it was all, you know, we were really... Oh, and while we were in the Air Cadets, we spent one camp at Halton RAF base and another one at Biggin Hill. And at Biggin Hill, we were there in... it must have been 41, because the Battle of Britain was over by then, but they were doing the sweeps over France, and we could see them going off on those sweeps.
What were was the kind of content of the lectures that you had with the air training?
Oh, well, we did a certain amount of navigation. We did Morse code. We did signalling with flags. We did aircraft recognition. Well, that's about all I can remember, but we kept pretty busy and we were very keen.
How did you do the aircraft recognition? Was it just posters or was there models? Or
No, I don't think we had models. We had like cards with silhouettes on them, and they were shown to us quickly, like a pack of cards. What's that? What's this? And we were all pretty good at it, I must admit.
And what kind of level did you go to with Morse training? Was it learning the code or did you actually practice?
No, we actually practiced. Yeah, we actually practiced with a buzzer. I was all right, but it wasn't exactly my favourite subject. Had I been better at it, I might well have been made to train as an observer. So maybe it was a good thing I wasn't that clever at it. But we got by.
How did you come to volunteer for the Fleet Air Arm? What was the process that occurred?
Well, do you want me to tell you two or three stories here? Because it's quite funny. I think it's quite funny. Being at school with Peter Jupe, we knew we wanted to volunteer because we didn't want to wait to be called up for something. So we were going to volunteer. And we'd had various talks from people from the RAF had come to the school. and one or two from the Navy. My the head boy of my house, my house captain, that's a better way of putting it, who was also an excellent rugby player and 880 yards runner, so he was a school hero, put it that way. He went off into the Fleet Air Arm very early in the war. He was 2 or 3 years older than me. And before we knew where we were, he was a hero in all the papers because he got a DSC in the Bismarck affair. He was an observer in one of the Swordfish against the Bismarck. So, I mean, we all thought of the Fleet Air Arm as something quite special. But the real reason that I volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm was that at the age of 17 and a quarter, you could volunteer for the Air Force or the Fleet Air Arm. If you passed the interview board and the medical board, then you had to sort of, you were then really in a situation of what do you do. Now, in the Navy, you expressed a preference for being trained as a pilot, or at least I did, and if you were up to it and if they wanted you, then that's what you were down to be trained as, a pilot. From the age of 17 and a quarter, I knew I was going to be trained as a pilot. Had I gone into the RAF, they would have accepted me as an aircrew candidate, but my understanding was that you did about 12 weeks ITW, initial training wing, where you stamped about in big boots and all that sort of thing. And then, only then, did they decide whether you were going to be a pilot, navigator, bomb aimer, signaller, or what. And that was not for me. I was going to be a pilot or nothing. Had I failed my pilot's course, then there was a possibility that I could have retrained as an observer. But thank goodness that didn't happen.
So it really relied then, I would say, on the selection interview and medical then, was it, with the Fleet Air Arm?
Yes, well, you had to have the school certificate and all that sort of thing, and you had to have your maths and all those sort of things. But provided you had those, and provided you were fit, good eyesight and all that sort of thing.
What was the medical, at that stage, what was the medical really looking for? You mentioned good eyesight, but was there...
Well, just general physical fitness, I suppose. I can remember the interview and the medical took place at number 6 Cockspur Street in London. I can remember going up there in my school blazer, by the way, and sitting in front of an interview board with all these people with brass around their arms, and goodness knows what. But it was... That was it. But the medical side of it, well, I think you had to be able to blow up a column of mercury to show that your lungs were working well, and you had to balance on one leg and balance with your eyes shut and all that sort of... Oh, and colour blindness. That was the other interesting thing. They gave you charts where there were actually patterns in little tiny dots in that. And that was quite difficult. But colour blindness was something they were looking for.
With the kind of selection interview, what were the type of questions they were asking about? What were they trying to find out?
Well, the first thing is, do you ride a horse? Which tickled me. I couldn't even drive a car. Well, my dad never had a car, so, I mean, I couldn't drive a car. But I had learned that one of the questions could do with the internal combustion engine, and I'm no engineer, but I knew enough about the internal combustion engine to know what happened and how it worked and that sort of thing. So I think I satisfied them on that. Then we had aircraft recognition on this thing, and then of course they were interested now in what you did at school. So I was shouting my head off about being school vice captain and second head boy or something, and played rugby, and that seemed to impress them. But I didn't ride a horse.
Were they looking for really, do you think at that stage as well, kind of all-rounders, people who could who were interested in sport but also had the academic side as well?
Oh yes, they, obviously if you were interested in sport, that was a big point. And I suppose, well, without trying to blow a trumpet, I mean, they were looking for potential leaders. So the fact that you'd been sort of deputy head boy and got two stripes in the cadets and that sort of thing was probably in your favour.
When had the selection interview and medical taken place?
When? Well, when I was 17 and a quarter. That was the earliest you could volunteer. You couldn't join up, you couldn't actually put uniform on until you were 18. So at 17 and a quarter you could volunteer. I think it was March 1942, that's right, when I knew that I was going to be in the Fleet Air Arm.
Were you sent a letter or something to confirm that after the procedure?
Can't remember whether, well, I must have had a letter. I don't remember whether they actually told us on the spot. I think they did. But when we knew we were in, we joined, there was a... We were quite proud of a thing. There was we had a badge on our cadet uniform called the RNYE, which was the Royal Navy. Well, it was meant to be the Royal Navy Youth Scheme. So it just showed people that you were going to be in the Navy, and we wore as air crew cadets, we wore a little white flash in our training in our caps. And we really thought we were the bee's knees, but we were still at school.
How long was it from obviously being selected to the point where you were actually called up?
I stayed at school. I took my higher school certificate in the June of 42. Don't know how I did it, but I passed. Because to be perfectly truthful, I was not interested much more in school type of education. I wanted to be a pilot and that was that. But I passed the higher schools. I stayed at school, probably a bit silly, but I stayed at school until I was 18, which was in December 42. And by then I'd got a letter saying I was to join the 47th Pilots course at Leon Solent on the 28th of December with a warrant from a train fare and that sort of thing. So that was it, and we joined up on the 28th of December 1942. I can remember it as well as it.
Can you tell me about that day, how you got down there and how you were received when you arrived?
Can tell you a bit about it. As I say, there were the three of us from Esher. There was Peter Jupe, school chum, a chap called Dickie Bell, and Dickie Bell's father had a car, and he drove us from Esher to Esher station with a, I don't know, whether they had a case, I suppose, something. We didn't take much with us except I didn't have a school blazer on then. I was wearing a sports jacket, and we all stood on Esher station. It was freezing cold. You can see over Sandown Park Racecourse, covered in frost and ice and goodness knows what. No racing, the Welsh Guards were being trained there in those days. But we stood on the station, Peter Jupe's sister was there to say goodbye to us. And we just climbed on this train, which took us down to Southsea. It was one of these trains that, I don't know what you call it, it didn't have corridors. You just got into a compartment. And it was about, oh, I suppose, 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning. And we got into this compartment, and there were a lot of white-faced lads sitting in there already. And we all looked at one another, and we thought, where are you going, where are you going? Go join the Fleet Air Arm. So we were all sitting in this compartment together, and I often wonder, you know, of those people we met in that compartment, how many of them actually survived. I can't remember their names particularly, but because once we got to Southsea, we were then shown how to go to Leon Solent, that's where it was, HMS Daedalus. And of course we were then divided up into huts. I think there were about, 30, 40 of us per hut. But it was all done alphabetically. So I was with A, B, C, D and all this, and the chap who had the bunk above me was Cyril Edmonds. I was underneath him. There was Dickie Bell, Graham, Connie Bell, Peter Jupe. Of course, he was in the next hut because his name his name didn't coincide. But that was it. So we were all shoved into this hut.
And that first day, was that all that really happened? Were you just shown your accommodation? Were you fed at all?
Oh, yes. We were shown where the mess hall was, and I think we had a sort of high tea. I think that was the first meal we had. And the two other things you found out very, very quickly was, one, where was the naffy? Because you needed to supplement the food sometimes, if you could afford it, that was. The other thing you needed to know very quickly was, where were the wren's quarters? But they were well chained off and fenced off. You couldn't just walk in and out of there, but it was nice to know where they were, just in case.
What was the accommodation like?
Well, they were Nissen huts. Great. No, they weren't Nissen huts. No, that's not. Nissen huts have got rounded roofs. These were a little bit more permanent than that. Just long huts with beds on either side, two tiers. A stove in the middle, coal burning stove, maybe two stoves, can't remember, and you had a locker, and sort of a lino floor, if I remember rightly, and it was jolly, jolly cold. It really was, because it was a very cold winter, and you were issued with, you know, knife, fork, mug and spoon and that sort of thing, and bedding, but you didn't get sheets. The Navy didn't give you sheets, you just had blankets. And I think the next day probably we were issued with our uniform, and it took probably the best part of the day to teach us how to put a sailor's uniform on, because it's not easy.
What are the difficulties with it initially?
Well, the fly buttons don't work like normal fly buttons. You have a flap that comes up, and you've got your bell bottom trousers. And then you wear a very tight jersey in the winter months, and then the top jersey on top of that. But the real problem was the collar, because the collar had to go on underneath the jersey, and then somebody, your mate, had to sort of get the collar out and put it over the back of you. And that was the other interesting thing, because as a rookie, the collar that you had was very, very deep blue, almost black, with the three white stripes around the edge. And to show that you'd got service, you needed a collar that was pale, washed out. So a lot of time was spent scrubbing these things, trying to get the colour out of it. But then if you overdid it, the colour ran into the white, and you were in all sorts of trouble. So it was probably best left to take its course.
Who was instructing you on how to get the uniform on? Was there somebody set aside to do
that? Well, we had instructors. They were either leading seamen or petty officers. Most of them had been retired and were called back from retirement. And they were wonderful characters. You know, they'd done their time in the Navy, they really had, and they were tough characters. They'd nearly all got service stripes. And it would have been very easy for them to resent us, because they knew that, provided we survived the training, we were mainly going to be officers. And I mean, they'd spent years and years on the lower deck and probably never got higher than petty officer, or maybe chief petty officer. But they taught us everything. They taught us all the wrinkles, you know, what you could get away with. And there were lots of things that you could get away with. I mean, the obvious thing, you've heard this before, is when you're on parade, when you're on the duty watch, it means you're confined to the bat and you've got jobs to do. Well, if you haven't got much of a job to do, you didn't want to be seen skiving about, because somebody would grab you and send you off to do some menial job. So the best thing was to walk about with a piece of paper under your arm, or a book or something, and pretend, just say, I'm taking this to so-and-so.
when your uniform was issued, was it the case that everyone's fitted, or did you have to have it slightly retailored, or did people have to swap kit?
I don't know. It's extraordinary. No, they you stood in front of a long counter with a storekeeper, petty officer, or somebody, and he sized you up pretty well, and he just chucked these things at you. And surprisingly, they did seem to fit pretty well. I think there were one or two mismatches. Obviously, you took them back and changed them. But you had boots and shoes and all that sort of thing, and your cap size, well, you knew your cap size, so you had that. And then you got the white band to put on your cap, which was something we were very proud of, to show that we were trainee officers.
Did you have to put your names into the clothing?
Yes, oh yes, that was a brilliant idea, that you were issued with a lump of wood, a strip of wood with your... I don't know, I can't remember whether you had your name like a stencil on that piece of wood, or whether you had your service number. Do you want to know my service number? FX91957. You never forget it, do you? Anyway, you got the stencil and some, I can't remember, it was paint or ink or what, but you just stamped them onto your clothes. If you had, like, your uniform, navy blue, you obviously stamped it with a white marker. And if it was something else, with a black marker. I don't know how you ever did your shoes and boots and that sort of thing. Presumably you just had to write something in there. But everything had to be marked.
You mentioned that took probably the best part of that first day. What was the next kind of... Second, once your uniform had been issued, how did you start your training?
Well, I think almost the next day, is we all had to line up for an inoculation. don't ask me what it was for, anti-tetanus or something, whatever. But we all stood in a line with our arms bared, and they stuck these needles into you. Never worried me in the slightest, but you'd be surprised. Great hunking chaps. Great big rugby forward type fellows fainting at the thought of being stuck with a needle, and I actually saw two or three of them have to be carried off to the side, you know. Anyway, we had these inoculations, and then of course your arms stiffened up, and then you had to put this blooming uniform on, and you had no excuse. Somehow you had to struggle into this uniform. And that was on the second or third day, and that wasn't so clever.